Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. You are listening, as you know, to the only show that gives you the academic evidence and the academic-based solutions on what we need to do to get the federal government back into check. And as you can hear, and you can probably see all sorts of things, the federal promises of nobody left behind, everybody gets tested, blah, blah, blah. All of these things are outside the scope and are not enumerated within the Constitution. And as you've learned here, this is why it's so important to understand academically the limitations of the federal government. And in doing so, as you research this, as you find out for yourself that they have no constitutional standing or power, then the only conclusion one can make is the fact that they are usurping powers either that belong to the state, or they're just making up these powers that the government really has no business doing. As a matter of fact, it was repugnant to the framers to think that government would be involved in administering what we call, what I refer to as compassionate services to the individual people. That was strictly a church or a religious responsibility. It's only because of the secular, godless people that said, hey, we don't have our own church, so we're going to make government our church, and ergo this whole transition and evolution of the secular, godless people, and this I'll just say it's a very pernicious movement that was initiated by the global elitist, or I should say Adam Weishaupt, and I talk about this all the time. The fact of the matter is, this was a slow transition where they've transformed our government from supposedly a sterile institution of providing very specific services to becoming the provider of godless secularism and the mechanism of indoctrinating and forcing all to be taught and learn and accept godless secularism. That's why I'm... I've been writing, and this is in my first book, but what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to write articles, extracts from that book that make such salient points in proving how, you know, even though there's no physical church, there's no pile of bricks with an anointed preacher, there is a religious organization that has been erected by the federal government. And again, it is a godless secularism or a godless secular church that they have created and that they have mandated that all, no God shall come before thy mighty government. And that's how they're the ones that dictate whether you can pray in public. And as I've said, when we go through the Constitution and Constitution Week and we get through the Bill of Rights, and it is very clear that the federal government, not just Congress, the Supreme Court has no jurisdiction and cannot make and or rule on laws regarding religion. And yet they have grown into even that responsibility, which is why it was completely repugnant for the government at all, at any level, even at the state level. So what they were doing at the state level was that the government would align with a church. Now, the problem was when they migrated, and I know I'm going on a little tirade because we need to get into the ratification debates, but I want you to understand this, that as they morphed or as they transitioned away from having a single religious entity administering compassionate services to the people of the state, because what they were doing was they were taxing the people and providing some of the taxes to assist that church in educating and providing health care and the fundamental compassionate services in the community and throughout the state. And so what ended up happening is as they transitioned away from that, all of a sudden, you know, the people, because the church didn't have this funnel or this little bit of money, a stipend coming from the state, so the church actually said, you know, we can't afford to do this on our own, which caused this transition from this state-sponsored churches to, you know, create this money-making mechanism for Christianity. It was a big driver that caused the Second Awakening and evangelical troops and type of, I'll just call it worship and preaching and so forth, where instead of a church being stationary in one spot, there was this idea, hey, if we just created this traveling church, then we could go around and get money from the different towns, you know, and separate these good people from their good money, and then they go to the next town, and they would never be around when all of a sudden those people who gave money to the church that might need some help or some assistance, they were never there to help them. They were just there long enough to take your money and move on. Now, I would probably say if you one really want to do an expose on this whole transition and evolution of the Second Great Awakening in that light and in that context, one would probably find that they started making tweaks and adjustments to their tour schedules to ensure that they were hitting towns shortly after, you know, revenue time, like after the harvest and those types of things. And then the troops would kind of take a little break, and then they'd get back out and go on this circuit. And next thing you know, they made more money off of the people. But the churches that were left behind that, you know, these people would go to on a regular basis, well, you know, they were the ones stuck having to take care of them. And unfortunately, the money that they needed to administer to the people went out that way. Now, you got to understand that at the same time, these local churches were layman's churches. John Adams' father, who was a minister or a leader in a layman's Puritan church type of thing, he also was a cobbler. So in other words, his livelihood was based upon his cobbler work, and that's how he provided for his family. He did not make money from the church to, you know, to subside for his family, to give his family the necessary housing, food, and so forth. In other words, religion was not a professional service at that point in time. Only the Catholic Church and those types of institutions were, you know, what I would call professional services, where people were dedicating their entire life to those, to that calling, let's call it. And so anyway, the whole point is, as we migrated away from these paradigms into supposedly this secularism, or actually non-denominational government, where the state governments were no longer tied or associated to a specific church, this is where we actually saw where those atheists said, hey, you know, you need to provide compassionate services for everybody, regardless. And that's how we've gotten into this mess of entitlement, that regardless of what you do or what you're doing or the kind of life you have, because a church would not necessarily give money to somebody that was just spending it on booze, tobacco, you know, and riotous living. They want to see, because the parishioners are, it's about morality. There's this need of helping people that want to become self-sufficient and want to be able to contribute to society. It's not about just, okay, well, go get your fix. Here's some money. Go get your fix. That right there is enabling bad behavior, and it is very destructive to society. And ergo, we have a government that is deliberately enabling bad behavior and is enabling the destruction of our society. It's the same thing with welfare, period. When you start handing out welfare, when you go to a country that is in need and you just give them free food, free food, and free food, after a couple of years and all of a sudden you can't do that anymore, they start complaining, hey, where's our free food? Anyway, I digress. This show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And like I said, this is the only show that provides the evidence-based solutions. Now, we only have one citation left. That is the Virginia ratification debates. One more citation there. And then we're going to get into the New York ratification debates. And then, hopefully, maybe in our next episode, we might actually get into some, you know, constitutional perspectives, you know, the outcome of Circus Maximus as they start traveling around through these early primaries. By the way, there are states that are accommodating the push for having an early primary so that they can establish a long-term squaring off of the two-party nominations or the challenger to, obviously, Trump. And so I'll get into, you know, my feelings on that, but we are being screwed as far as an informed public, because it is during a dragged-out long-term, when you don't have a lot of time to get into a general. The parties have done this deliberately, one, to help the incumbent, and or two, to help the challenger. And early primaries actually can do both, but what we want to do is we want to basically prove to you over time that the true race is always in the primary. Because that's where you really separate the wheat from the chaff. That's where you can really delineate. So when they have short primaries or a short run-up to the primary, then all of a sudden everybody just backstrokes. Because 9 times out of 10, in most all elections, whoever wins the primary will win that seat or the office that they're running for. We will be right back after these two promos, and we will be in the Virginia ratification debates when we do. Thank you so much. Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their Constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so this last citation, it's not a long one, but it's not a short one either. This last citation is by Mr. Zachariah Johnson. And this is on June 25th, and this is right before they really start convening to voting and all of that. So these are kind of summation comments and so forth. This is an important citation because this gets into the fundamental inalienable rights that were completely understood, that the Declaration of Independence actually laid the foundation for, you know, what our inalienable rights are. So, you know, we have these rights that we can't lose, and then they create this government at the state level by delegating very specific powers to them. And now they're creating this I'll just call it a hybrid constitutional republic federation. And when I say federation, a very limited and defined enumerated power, general government or federal government. And so, because we act that this hybrid constitutional federation is actually not a federation, it is a confederation with, you know, very specific, again, specific powers enumerated. That's why it's a hybrid. And most people don't realize, they think that, oh, well, this is a federation, a federal government. No, they did not consolidate all powers, nor did they grant general powers to the general government. They kept them a check. And we're going to get into that. And we've been getting into that over the past month. And that's the reason why we're taking all of this time to do this, is to give you irrefutable evidence that, you know, what the federal government says they are and says they can do and everything else flies in the face of how that government was defined by the framers when they were creating it. The government is not the omnipotent God that created all things. To be clear, the states created it. And in doing so, they delegated these specific powers. So anyway, this is what Mr. Johnson says. I shall consider several other parts which are much objected to as to the regulation of the militia. I feel myself doubly interested. Having a numerous offspring, I am careful to prevent the establishment of any regulation that might entail the oppression on them. When gentlemen of high abilities in this House, and whom I respect, tell us that the militia may be subjected to martial law in time of peace, and whensoever Congress may please, I am astonished. Okay, so, you know, you're already catching up to these little, I'll just call them highlights of what we're talking about, or one of the final focuses. Here he's talking about martial law and, you know, how these people are asserting that it can be done at any point in time as Congress wishes. And he says, I am much astonished. My judgment is astray and exceedingly undiscerning if it can bear such a construction. Congress has only the power of arming and disciplining them. The states have the appointment of the officers and the authoring of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. When called into actual service of the United States, they shall be subject to the marching orders of the United States. Then and only then, it ought to be so, sir. And that's what he's talking about as far as, you know, the establishment of martial law. Only when the militia is called in very specific service to perform either the execution of law, the suppression of rebellion, and or the, you know, repelling invasion. They've gone through this several times, and so we're recapping kind of, but I think that this is the important thing to note. As one understands and one sees what the heck's going on across this nation, one can see that the final play of going after guns is in effect. And because we have completely lost sight of the fact that we are to be a self-governed people, which means that we are all responsible for enforcing the law, suppressing rebellion, like protest, Antifa getting out and not liking what they want, that is unconstitutional, and as well as repelling invasion. And we see the progressives saying, we don't want a wall, we want open borders. In other words, they are in outright rebellion against the Constitution. because they're literally bringing people here to become voters so that they can use a democracy to overthrow our Constitution. Well, we're just going to vote our way out of this. And bottom line, they have been deliberately obfuscating the fact that there is a process to this change. It is not done at the, you know, literally at the ballot through a form of democracy. It has to be done in an amendment. And they have turned their backs on this hard R requirement, capital R requirement. Anyway, so he says, then and only then it ought to be so. When we advert to the plan and the obvious meaning of the words without twisting and torturing their natural signification, we must be satisfied that this objection is groundless. He had adverted to the true meaning and not gone further or farther, we would not be here today, but should have come to a decision long ago. We are also told that religion is not secured, that religious tests are not required. So here you get this little glimpse, because I've told you before that every state wanted to invoke religious tests. And the Constitution clearly forbid that no religious tests shall be applied, because they were not to have any say over religion, period. And when they talked about religion, they were talking very specifically faith-based, because when you start sitting down and having a test on religion, well, which doctrine do you want to follow? And I don't want to say generic Christian, because when you get three different, let's just call them, you know, faiths, in, you know, on the table to negotiate this, you know, they're going to basically try to twist or have their faith injected into that test. Anyway, as he said, that religious tests are not required. You will find that the exclusion of tests will strongly tend to establish religious freedom. If, and to be honest, an unintended consequence of doing this, unleash this concept of Satan worshiping. Well, now all of a sudden we're supposed to allow Satan worshiping. No, the federal government was not to have any ability to establish or support the establishment of religion. The 14th Amendment does not and did not go after organizational rights. In other words, the state could actually state that certain religions are banned and were banned, and certain and actually state-sponsored religions were still supported and were still operating after the 14th Amendment. The federal government never went after any of those states that had state-sponsored religions at that time. So what gives? Well, what gives is that they took this movement of making godless secularism the fundamental church, and they slowly changed the paradigm through education and everything else to where by 1920, the federal government stepped into the Snopes trial and said, you will teach evolution. So this is kind of why I started on this little religious rant in the beginning. If tests were required, and if the Church of England or any other church were established, I'm going on with Mr. Johnson's comments, I might be excluded from any office under the government because my conscience might not permit me to take the test required. Folks, we've actually allowed the godless secular church to take over, and actually they are applying religious tests to this day. If you're a politician with Christian faith, then they will attack you for your position on homosexual marriage. They will attack you and they say, what is your view on abortion? And they, see, this person wants to mandate a religious perspective. And to me, how is that not a religious test? How are they not violating the Constitution when the media starts injecting these religious tests? Who is the media? The media is a part of it's the PR for this church. It's the public relations for the godless secular church. And the education system is the what's the best word for it? I want to use conflict or contrary, but it's actually, it counters church's Sunday school because the education system has a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday school, right? And so what are the odds of you being able to maintain the religious doctrine that you want your kids to get and live life by when they're being exposed to such perverse concepts in the education system? Anyway, moving on, he says this. Let me just kind of repeat this. If tests were required, and if the Church of England or any other were established at the federal level, I might be excluded from any office under the government because my conscience might not permit me to take tests required. Oh, I'm sorry, we've ran out of time. So when we come back, we will get into his furthering comments. And he's actually going to make a comment regarding the right to bear arms. And so he's creating this paradigm of we still retain all of these rights, but this government is constrained in keeping certain things from happening, and religious tests is one of those. We'll be right back after this.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so if we look at how he kind of lays out these comments, right? He started off with this concept of martial law and the militia. And then he gets into religion and what we're going to get into next is he comes right back to martial law and guns and so forth. Anyway, Mr. Johnson then says, the diversity of opinions regarding religion, the diversity of opinions and variety of sects, S-E-C-T-S, in the United States have justly been reckoned a great security with respect to religious liberty. The difficulty of establishing a uniformity of religion is, in this country is immense. They wanted to make sure, though, in the Constitution that it mentioned no religion. Remember, it is an enumerated Constitution. If it's not mentioned, they can't meddle with it. But people still wanted the Bill of Rights. Ergo, Madison did his best attempt to create specific. So you have the specific delegation of powers as well as specific hardcore limitations to keep the federal government from trying to imply their ability to inject into other issues, because that was the big fear of everybody, that the federal government was going to try to usurp and, you know, meddle into things it had no business doing. Everybody understands the danger of that. Everybody understands that once you give power to something, that power, the desire to increase and enlarge that power, just is, it's naturally overwhelming, especially in the hands of humans. Whether it be woman or man, human beings always want to magnify their control and power. It is, whether you call it a lust or what have you, it is the weakness of human nature. There we go. So anyway, as he says, the difficulty of establishing a uniformity of religion in this country is immense. The extent of this country is great. The multiplicity of sects, S-E-C-T-S, is very great likewise. Now here he comes right back again to the guns. The people are not to be disarmed of their weapons. They are left in full possession of them. Now, so what he just said, based on this Constitution, the people are not to be disarmed of their weapons. They are left in full possession of them. Now, stepping back, the Constitution did not mention anything about disarming. As a matter of fact, it actually galvanized the requirement of all people being armed because of the militia and how they laid out the militia in two facets, the organized militia as well as the unorganized militia. And if you haven't read my article on this, go to Constitutional Articles page on my ReclaimingTheRepublic.org website. I clearly point out that the concept was that even if the militia started going and wandering, you know, and using force, the people could, because they had weapons as well, could protect themselves from even a tyrannical militia. It was a brilliant layout. It was a brilliant design. Only in the grand picture, putting and connecting all of these dots and these layers of protections and so forth, there is no way that, you know, any or all of these men were able to create such a design to know that down the road, when we got to such a point of tyranny, we can actually look at what was created through these founding documents, the ratification debates, and go, wow, snap. Now we have a way back. We have been given the process, or I should say, the power, the authority, the assertion of being able to get back to the original intent of this compact. And that is these ratification debates. So, again, he says the people are not to be disarmed of their weapons. They are in full possession of them. The government is administered by the representatives of the people, voluntarily and freely chosen. Under these circumstances, should anyone attempt to establish their own system in prejudice of the rest, they would be universally detested and opposed and easily frustrated. However, over a period of a long time, one can be massaged, manipulated, and coerced and/or deceived into believing that things, you know, aren't that way. But what's the threat? You know, it's like today when I talk to people about how, you know, your phone is constantly spying on you, and people just, yeah, I know, and I don't like that, but, you know, it's the nature of life. Really? Really? I don't get that. I mean, I haven't ranted on this, and if I have, I've totally blacked it out. I can't understand why people use their phones as a computer instead of using a computer. Oh, because this is just always on my hip and I can do so many great things with it. Well, actually, if you understand the dangers, the threat, the physical threat that that phone puts on your body just in its emanations of electromagnetic energies, the tumors and all those things, if you haven't read Orlene Kolk's book on Whoa Nelly, 5G, and the dangers of, you know, all this technology, then you need to get informed and get, you know, get involved, because I will tell you, if you read that book and you understand the dangers of these devices, and I'm sorry for going on this aside, but if you understand the dangers of these devices and you give these to your kids, as far as I'm concerned, you are committing child abuse by allowing your kids to have a phone and putting them up next to their heads and not letting them know. I mean, it's almost like letting them eat lead. Why don't you let your children eat lead? Because you know it's harmful to them. Well, why would you give your kids a phone unless you don't know it's harmful to them? Why would they want you to have a phone? Why does everybody have a phone? As a matter of fact, I will tell you, in China, they give their people phones. And if you want a better phone, you can buy one. But everybody shall have a phone because it is the mechanism of being tracked and being monitored. And they do it. The people do it because that's what they're told. Now, if they could only get America to be that way. But the fact of the matter is, these things are harmful to our health. Anyway, as I was saying, you know, he's pointing out that these people, if they tried to oppose these principles, that, you know, they would actually arm themselves. They would stand up and go, stop this. But they don't do it over a slow, gradual period. Madison's even pointed this out in previous debates, as well as the Federalist Papers, that it is through a gradual migration and transition of going from one type of government to another type. Again, we had a distributive government, and now we have a collective government, a government that's trying to pull everything in and control everything at the center, instead of distributing and allowing control to be at the furthest reaches from the center of government, or I should say the federal or national seat. Anyway, getting back to Mr. Johnson's comments, or, you know, this summation, this is a principle which secures religious liberty most firmly. The government will depend on the assistance of the people in the day of distress. This is the case in all governments. It never was otherwise. They object to this government because it is strong and energetic, and with respect to the rich and the poor, that it will be favorable to one and oppressive to the other. It is right, it should be energetic. This does not show that the poor shall be more oppressed than the rich. Let us examine it. If it admits that private and public justice should be done, it admits what is just. As to the indolent and fraudulent, nothing will reclaim these but the hand of force and compulsion. Is there anything in this government which will shiny that it will bear hardly and unequally on the honest and the industrious part of the community? I think not. As to the mode of taxation, the proportion of each state being known cannot be exceeded. And actually, so that's not true, because what ended up happening, well, so I should say it is true based on the foundation, but as things progressed, that even got perversed, because if you look, let's just go back to the 2008-2009 meltdown, right? Every state was paying taxes, but what state got the tax money that is being taken from us? What state got an inordinate amount of trillions of dollars poured into it? New York. Into the stock market and into those institutions in New York. And what ended up happening is all these local banks throughout the nation failed, car dealerships failed, and so forth. And very little bit of stipends went out, but we're talking trillions of dollars in the TARP fund. If you don't understand that, You know, how they're laying this out is how the government was supposed to behave and how they couldn't do those things. And now I'm contrasting that with the fact that they're doing things that these guys are saying can't be done. How did we get into this position? Only through the lies and obfuscations. We'll be right back after these two promos. I don't want to bleed into it again. Thank you so much. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. And so Mr. Johnson also points out another thing that I kind of missed, or I have not done a good job in articulating and pointing out regarding the oppression of the rich and the poor. So I'm going to jump back a little bit and read this over again. He says, "They object to this government because it is strong and energetic, and with respect to the rich and the poor, that it will be favorable to one and oppressive to the other." In other words, it was under the guise of this is going to be oppressive to the poor and favorable to the rich. "It is right. It should be energetic. This does not show that the poor shall be more oppressed than the rich. Let us examine it." And before we go on, I want you to understand that what he's pointing out here is the fact that because of taxation, the poor are going to have to suffer because everybody has to pay taxes. The concept of the government being involved in compassionate services and welfare, taking from one and giving to another, was not even in the picture. The design was clear that the government was to perform functions and it was supposed to tax to be able to pay for that. It was never, never designed to become a government of socialism, social engineering, and a design of redistributing wealth. There is zero evidence of that. And this testimony actually points to the fact that the government was designed to be one way and one way only, to take taxes from all, and I'll just try to use the word apportionately, and it was to basically go to the states and say, based on the amount of heads that you have, you need to give us this much tax. There was never a mechanism to say, oh, by the way, once we take that money, we're going to give it back to the money that they were to take was only for them to exercise the powers delegated, which welfare and housing and all of those types of assistances were never designed within this, and that's why they were not enumerated, and that's why the federal government has usurped those powers. So he says, let us examine it. If it admits that private and public justice should be done, it admits what is just. As to the indolent, what's the indolent? Those people not doing anything, those people that are, you know, beggars, panderers, they're not productive in society, right? What's a good synonym for indolent? Lazy, lethargic, idle, sluggish, slothful, apathetic, laid back, and fraudulent, and we know what fraudulent means, people that are trying to scam, cheat, and so forth. Nothing will reclaim these but the hand of force and compulsion. So in other words, what he's talking about is, you know, they understood that the worst thing for society is to allow indolence and fraudulence to get a foothold and to start growing. And what's the best way to give them a foothold and start growing? Shoot, it's by giving them money, creating a welfare state. You know, people complain all the time about the houseless or the homeless and the housing crisis of all these poor people and these people living on the street. What we're talking about is we've created an education system that has assured people, don't worry, we're going to take care of you. You are entitled. It doesn't matter how, you know, how debased you've become and the debauchery that you live. It doesn't matter. We're going to make sure you get every penny. And we're going to take it from those people who are rich that don't deserve that money. And in doing that, we have indoctrinated through our education system this level of insanity that we are dealing with in our streets with homeless people. They're calling it a drug addiction problem when it's an education problem, when it is a government problem. Because bottom line, the government is driving that curriculum. The government is inculcating our society. And that's why we never look at the problems in the perspective that we should. You have to always look upstream. Where is this coming from? Where do these people get this idea that they're entitled? Well, the government. Do you get it? This is the secular godless church they created. Moving on, Mr. Johnson says, is there anything in this government which will shiny that it will bear hardly and unequally on the honest and industrious part of the community? I think not. Unfortunately, socialism and the communist movement has perpetrated itself or has penetrated our government, and now we literally are living in a backwards, a bizarro world based on a Jerry Seinfeld episode. We are in a bizarro world. We're living under a government that has no base. We're living in a government that has usurped all these powers and has created this house of cards, this facade, that they can do all of these things. As to the mode of taxation, Mr. Johnson goes on, the proportion of each state being known cannot be exceeded, and such proportion will be raised in the most equitable manner of the people according to their ability. Well, at least until communism and socialism slowly creeps in and we start polluting ourselves with these destructive government ideologies and agendas. There is nothing to warrant a supposition that the poor will be equally taxed with the wealthy and the opulent. I'll repeat, there is nothing to warrant a supposition that the poor will be equally taxed with the wealthy and the opulent. In other words, they're not going to overly oppress them. But the fact of the matter is everybody will have an equal share of responsibility in supporting the government however they can. But that's left to the states to decide. The government was not capable of directly taxing individuals. Moving on, I shall make a comparison to illustrate my observations between the state and the general government. In our state government, so much admired by the worthy gentleman over the way, though there are 1,700 militia in some counties and but 150 in others, Yet every county sends two members to assist in legislating for the whole community. Now, the whole community being the state. But he's pointing out that each county had representation in that body of government, regardless of how many militia members were in one. So in other words, he was talking about militia members regarding the population centers or the population of these counties. Do you understand? This right here is what I've been telling you regarding republicanism. States were designed to recognize counties as sub-elements of government. They were the seats. That's how they broke down their representation. That's how they broke everything down. Are you looking for hardcore evidence? Here you go. The proof is that counties were equally represented. And today, we've been indoctrinated to believe that we the people, you know, we have to have our equal vote, and the county lines have been smeared. The next border of sovereignty that is smearing or being smeared are the state governments. States are moving in the direction where they are going to willingly submit and surrender their sovereignty to a government that has no legal constitutional standing to be able to do it anyway. Anyway, he says, and I'll just kind of repeat that, though there are 1,700 militia in some counties, but only 150 in others, yet every county sends two members to assist in legislating for the whole state or community. There is disproportion between the respectable county of Augusta, which I have the honor to represent, and the circumscribed narrow of County Warwick. Will any gentleman tell us that this is more equal representation than is fixed in the Constitution, whereby 30,000 are to send one representative in whatever place they reside? By the same system, the poor in the many instances pay as much as the rich. Many laws occur in my mind where I could show you that the representation and taxation bear hard on those who live in large, remote back counties. The mode of taxation is more oppressive to us than the rest of the community. Last fall, when the principle of taxation was debated, it was determined that tobacco should be received in discharge of taxes, but this did not relieve us, for it would not fetch what it would cost as to the distance so great and the carriage of difficult. Other specific articles were not received in payment of taxes, so that we had no other alternative than to pay specie, in other words, paying money, which was a particular hardship. I could point out many other disadvantages which we labor under, but I shall not fatigue the House. Anyway, he goes on, but the whole point is that representation was equal at the state level in the county, and so was the taxation. And, you know, what they should have done was they should have made the taxation not based on the county, but the taxation apportioned by people, kind of like the federal government. But understanding this is the same thing with representation. And I believe that was, and I've told you this, that was very specifically why the states actually, after this constitution, went back and they changed their own constitutions, creating bicameral legislative bodies. And in so doing, they created a republic based on the model of the national republic, so that every county was represented in a bicameral legislative body. As I told you before, this actually concludes this. We'll be back with the New York ratification debates. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and Republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.